Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 313. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grayslake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with you. We have a great panel and a great discussion lined up for you. Let me introduce to you today first Jeff Waddington, who is an OPC minister. He serves pulpit supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back to the program, Jeff. It's great to speak with you.
Oh, it's great to be here on this beautiful sunny day and talk about this wonderful topic.
Yeah, we have a good one lined up for us, and we have an excellent guest. But before we get to her, we have a great panelist who's been on the program before as a guest. We welcome back to the program Mr. John Meether, who is the Dean of Libraries as well as Professor of Church History at Reformed Theological Seminary down in Orlando, Florida. Welcome back to the program, John. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Camden. It's a privilege to be here. And greetings from warm Orlando.
Yes, warmer than it is up north here. I should mention also that John is the historian for the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and that's a significant point as we turn to a bit of OPC history. We're very pleased to welcome to the program today for the very first time Caroline Weirstra, who is a member of Calvary OPC in Schenectady, New York. She's also an author, and many of you may know her as the founder of Catechism for Kids. Welcome to the program, Caroline. It's wonderful to have you on today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
We're going to be speaking about an excellent article that Caroline wrote, and it is published in the recent, most current edition of the Westminster Theological Journal. That is the fall 2013 edition, volume 75, number 2. The title of this article here is The Early History of Peniel Bible Conference, Part 1, Zeal Without Knowledge, 1933 to 1938. We are awaiting a second part that will come out, Lord willing, in the next edition of the journal. But we want to open this subject up and discuss an interesting point of OPC history. But before we do so, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. And we do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. We love doing what we do, and we love getting down into the bits and pieces of good, solid Reformed theology and church history, but we need your help, especially this time of year. Please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support. We thank you so much of all that you do in helping us here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. Now, I was saying early, before we got started, that when I got my issue of the journal, I was waiting for it fervently with a great anticipation by the mailbox. And when it finally showed up, I looked at the table of contents and saw this article, and it was the first thing I read. I needed to get into here and read this because this is an important piece of OPC history, but also one that isn't treated in great depth. And so we have something here with this article where we can open up this history and understand it now in a way where perhaps many of these details weren't accessible to the layperson or to the person looking at it from the outside. Caroline, could you tell us how you were introduced to this subject, as well as what eventually moved you to do research and perhaps even to write this academic piece?
Sure. Well, I attend Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Schenectady, which, as you mentioned, and I knew that from the beginning I'd heard some things around the church about the church being involved with the Peniel Bible Conference. I was new to the Reformed faith. I really didn't know anything about it. As I began to learn more about the Reformed faith, became more interested in Orthodox Presbyterian Church history, that became something of more interest to me, but still, it wasn't something that was talked about a lot at the church, except that when I went to read about the history of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, there was a little paragraph that said something about my church, that it was involved with the Peniel Bible Conference. And I asked my pastor about it. He says, oh, yes, we're famous for all the wrong reasons. And so I had found some old pictures in the church as I was beginning to go through some of the cabinets and, you know, clear out some stuff. And there were pictures of, you know, from long ago, the former pastor, Ray Miners, and so on. And I began asking people about it. They started to talk about this. And it became clear from the very beginning that they did not know that they were in a Reformed church early on. They did not know that they were part of the OPC. They said, well, when we came to it, we said we were going to the Peniel Church. We didn't know what the Presbyterian Church was. We didn't know what the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was. We didn't know anything about the Reformed faith. It wasn't until somewhat recently that we've learned that that we were in a Reformed church. So, of course, this is not something you expect to hear. So I started to research it more and to look into it. I actually went to Peniel Bible Conference, which is up in Lake Luzerne, and found some of their old records. They were very kind to me, allowed me to go through their stuff. And what emerged was this very fascinating story about how this church became or came to be, how these people became involved in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And it was something that I thought really ought to be said, ought to be spoken about more widely, I think has a lot of good lessons for us today.
I think so as well. And for the listeners who aren't connected with the OPC, this still has a lot of applicability because as we unfold the details of this event or these events, we come to see it has a lot to do with identity, with connection with the broader Christian church, with church government, accountability, also with charismatic issues and issues of sanctification. How do we discern God's will? How do we encourage one another in the faith? How do we rebuke one another? Those types of things, they all come together. They coalesce into this compendium of history here that focuses on this Peniel Bible Conference. It's fascinating for many reasons. John, I want to ask you, as we continue to introduce this topic, you've written quite a bit on American Presbyterianism, but also focusing on the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Could you tell me just briefly about your familiarity on this subject and its place within the broader sweep of OPC history?
I grew up in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church on Long Island, and my congregation was a member of the Presbytery of New York and New England. So I remember hearing faintly stories about Peniel growing up, and I went to Gordon College on the North Shore of Boston. At the church there and at the school, there, I heard a little bit more about Peniel, but really didn't get familiar with the movement until I co-authored The Brief History of the OPC, Fighting the Good Fight, to which we devote, Daryl Hart and I devote a chapter to the Peniel movement. That was my exposure. I think Caroline is certainly right. It is an underinterpreted and underappreciated part of our story, and I welcome this piece as a way of making that story more well-known and the lessons it ought to teach us.
Absolutely. Now, Caroline, you did mention something very interesting, especially in a denomination that is like the OPC. So many people are self-aware about their own denomination and its beliefs, more so than in broader evangelicalism, at least in my experience. How has that impacted Calvary OPC, and has the church over the years more grown into and developed into a self-conscious church, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, for a while, I didn't even know anything about Peniel when I first started attending here.
Yeah.
It's very much an Orthodox Presbyterian church now and very self-conscious in that manner. And I think even over time, it became more and more so. I think the hold of the Orthodox Presbyterian church grew much stronger on the church and Peniel less so. But if you ask some of the older people, I think still the loyalties of many of the people, certainly back even in the 70s and 80s, were first to Peniel and secondly to the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, mm-hmm. because that was where they were brought into it. That was their experience was more Peniel than the OPC, was something more distant and outside of themselves.
Who were some of the original figures relative to the Peniel Bible Conference? Let's talk about some of these people. They're quite interesting. And could you share for us a few names and also some of the background from which they came?
The main one that comes to mind, of course, is Mildred Kaiser McCullough. She was the founder of Peniel. She was a very young woman. When she founded Peniel, only in her mid-20s. And Peniel really began as a Methodist group. It did not begin Reformed at all, and none of the people initially had any Reformed connections. It was a Methodist youth group, and it was led by this young woman. And she had been raised in a nominal Christian family, as most of them had been. And through reading a tract, she became convicted of her sin, and she didn't know how to approach God. She didn't know what to do. She became very anxious, in fact, so anxious that she said her mother thought she was losing her mind. She would spend hours in prayer and very concerned about this, and she finally achieved some peace when somebody told her that, well, the way that you understand the will of God is that you free your life of sin, you become determined to do whatever God wants you to do, and you just then focus on whatever problem you have, and if you feel a peace in your heart about a certain direction, that's God speaking to you, and then you know what God wants you to do, and therefore, if you keep on that line, then God will bless you, and you will be in the will of God. So this was something that she latched onto she became very excited about. She began to tell all of her friends, and she eventually formed this group around herself, this youth group at the Methodist Church. And she taught this, and she was a dynamic young woman. People seemed to love her. They followed her. And she, with several friends, decided to found this camp for young people. It was really a dream of hers to minister to young people, to teach them about Jesus. And I think rightfully so, in the sense that they were in the middle of a situation. It was a lot of modernism in the church. There was a lot of teaching of just be a good person. There wasn't much of an emphasis on the Bible and on scripture and so on. So as off as she was, and in a sense she was trying to bring people to an understanding of Christ, so she founded this camp with the intention of teaching young people, and she brought on board a couple of her friends, Susan Beers, who had been a missionary to Japan and was then teaching at Albany Bible College nearby, and another woman named Rhoda Armstrong, who was also a teacher at Albany Bible College. So that's how it began. It was initially all of the teachers were women, and they were teaching young people. They were teaching especially high schoolers. So initially a small group, and it began to grow over time until it became literally thousands of people.
Mm. Now, were Bible camps a very common thing at the time? Is this a typical endeavor where a lot of denominations and other church groups doing this for young people?
Oh, yes. It was very common back then. And so in that sense, it wasn't an unusual thing to do. I think mm-hmm. how it became unusual was just it was a very intense organization. She was very Mildred was very insistent upon you really give your whole life to God. They would spend literally hours in prayer. There was a big emphasis on keeping sin away, keeping apart from the world. If they felt that someone was drifting away from these ideals, they would go and confront this person. They would sit with them for hours and talk to them. There was very intense psychological pressure. And I think that join the group together in a way that it otherwise would not have made them very cohesive, very dependent on each other. And they were all new Christians without any teaching really from the outside. And so it was left to their own interpretation of what the scriptures meant, and they came up with their own ideas and believed that they were following God.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seemed early on, and of course, they didn't have much theological training, and that it doesn't necessarily preclude anyone from developing and starting a helpful and a God-honoring Bible camp. But as you've already alluded to, there were some interesting pietistic structures here and some different understandings about God's revelation and the active role of the Holy Spirit in your present life in a way that deviates a bit from Reformed traditional teaching. You also mention here on page 300, you start to introduce some of these dynamics among the group, and you speak about the marriages and the romances that started to bud among some of the young men and some of the young ladies. But what I found so interesting is that many of these seem to be pragmatic unions to achieve a more effective ministry. What could you say to that effect, and what was going on among these people, and what were their goals, even in the romantic relationships, or maybe I should say just the marital relationships that they created?
Well, I think that they recognized that it was almost all female organization. There were one or two guys, there were several dozen women, and they recognized that certainly as a problem, that they could not be taken very seriously when they had no male leadership and so on. And so one of the things that it became is bringing in men. It was a way to, if you bring men into the organization, partly by their attachment to the women. And so this was a way almost that they saw to reach out to men, was that they would bring their boyfriends, they would bring their, you know, and so then it became a sort of a pressure on people that, well, if you want to keep this person in the organization, you must keep this romantic relationship, you must keep writing to them, become engaged to them, so on. Marriages were very much seen as involved in ministry, and in fact, Ray Miners, who was a little bit later, but became one of the key figures, he kept a running list of how many young women from our church married ministers, because that was And he would, many times he would tell people they could not marry a woman in the church unless they were planning to go into ministry. So it was a way to encourage, really, there was a strong pressure to go into ministry, to become a minister, to spread the message of Peniel, and which they believed was the best representation of the Bible, and to do so partly by through these romantic relationships, which would, you know, first of all, keep people in the Peniel group, and secondly, assist them in ministry.
Mm-hmm. Let's speak a little about Robert McCullough. He was an interesting figure as well, and connected to Mildred Kaiser. How did he become involved with Peniel, and how did his involvement change over the years?
Well, like most of the men, he was brought in because of his attraction to a young lady, Mildred Mildred Kaiser, specifically the founder of Peniel, and she led him to Christ, and so he was grateful to her certainly for that, and he helped her leading the youth group, and he was very attracted to her. It does not seem from the way things, the way that she talks, that she was that interested in a romantic relationship with him. She certainly allowed him to be in that, but she was very much devoted to her ministry, and that was her focus. She was not really interested in settling down and being married. But it became necessary that they, you know, some people said, well, if we are going to have a camp and Mildred insisted it must be both boys and girls, then we must have a married couple in charge of it. And so we think that you should get married to Robert McCullough. And so she agreed. And there's a whole very flowery story about how this came to be and her asking God and God giving her the date of the wedding and so on. But the long and short of it was she married Robert McCullough literally a week or so before they began their first camp. And Robert never became a teacher at Peniel, but he was very involved in the business side of things. He was running the business. He managed the business of it. I think if it hadn't been for Robert, they probably never could have kept the camp going. But he was very good at business and managing the legal aspects of things, and he took that on to a large degree in pretty much his entire life. And he also became an elder at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in 1940 and remained so until he retired.
The internal dynamics of the group that becomes the Peniel Bible Conference betrays their Methodist and, I would argue, holiness movement background. Given that that's my background, I have some experience in it. And it just wanted to note that it strikes us as Reform folk as very odd, maybe cult-like or sect-like, but very much in the holiness movement vein, which makes its connection with the OPC all the stranger. But, you know, we can get into that. Caroline, in your article, you do talk about, I would call it, the practical problem of finding a place to actually have the Bible camp. Can you share some about that?
Sure. They initially had been meeting on a campground that I believe belonged to Mildred's father. She never really talks about that, but it is alluded to in several of the other writings that her father certainly owned a camp up in Lake Luzerne, and I believe that they were holding in the early 30s a few events on that. But when they decided to formally launch their camp in 1933, for reasons that are not that clear to me, they decided they needed a new location. I don't know if they were hoping for a larger space, possibly something like that. So, again, there is a very flowery story about that. It's one of those things where I don't know. Mildred tells much of the history of Peniel. When she tells the history of it, there's much that just simply becomes incredulous. You know, you develop an incredulous attitude towards it. I'm not sure that it happened exactly the way that she said, or if the fish simply got bigger over the years. But the way that she tells it is that it was just down to the last moment where they were, you know, God insisted, she said, that they would have it at Lake Luzerne. And she says, we had options, other places, very attractive options, but no, God said it must be Lake Luzerne. So it comes down to the last minute. They don't have a place. They don't have a place. Finally, God says, or depending on which which account you read, her friend says, why don't we look in the classifieds? And they look in the classifieds, and lo and behold, there is an advertisement. They managed to find this camp, and so they began holding camp meetings there. The camp actually grew over the first couple of years, and it became a little bit larger, and they felt that they needed a nicer place than that. And so they began to look around for something else, and they happen upon an old hotel, which is the Wayside Inn, which was a beautiful, beautiful building, huge hotel that had been just the top of the, you know, presidents had stayed there and the Vanderbilts had stayed there. It was a wonderful, beautiful place in its day. But by this time, the Great Depression had hit. It was in disrepair and it seemed to have been condemned as a fire hazard. Why that was the case, I'm not sure. Whether it was electrical problems, I don't know. But it seemed to be very much aware that there were problems with it being a fire hazard. So,
in fact, it couldn't become insured, right? That was part of the problem.
Right.
Even if someone wanted to buy it, then they would have difficulty because no one would insure it.
That's right. Mm. That was one of the huge difficulties that they had. No one would even insure this. Everyone agreed that it was likely to burn down. So the man who owned it was looking for a buyer, and the Pinellas walk into it. They see how gorgeous it is, and they immediately say they feel peace in their hearts that God wants them to have this place, which, of course, if you have any experience with people who believe they're being led of God, they always believe that God leads them to have the thing that is, you know, that looks most attractive at the moment. So so they latch onto this. They're absolutely convinced this is what God wants them to do. They do a lot of fundraising and so on, and they actually managed to do it, and they managed to put down a deposit on it, and they finally found some obscure place to insure it and so on, and then the very next year, it burned to the ground. So at this point, they had to move back out into a campground. They used what was left of the insurance money to buy a campground and move back out there and began all over again.
Mm.
And so they kept kind of reinventing themselves as time went on. And you can see that even after that, I don't think I mentioned it in the article, but they had they built a chapel, and the chapel collapsed under the snow. So there were many things along the way that would have been setbacks, except that they believed truly that they were following God. And I think this made them pretty much impervious.
I would certainly agree with Caroline and Jeff that there is a holiness impulse at the start from Pinellas, which is at odds with the OPC. But I think it's important that we not overlook some affinities from the very start. For one thing, the dynamics, well, let me do a play on words. Richard Lovelace, a Pinellas alumnus, wrote the book Dynamics of Spiritual Life. If I may paraphrase that, there are dynamics of summer camp life that Caroline describes, which is very much similar to the experience of Christian camps and even OPC camps. For example, romances that come out of summer camps are notorious, and they're every OPC camp can produce a list of marriages that were made from camp. This is either the benefit or the risk of going to summer camp, depending on your perspective.
Yeah.
Something else she said that I was really struck, Caroline, you mentioned that the hymn "Lead On, O King Eternal," especially the line, "Henceforth in fields of conflict, thy tents shall be our home," was a popular hymn among Pinellists.
Yeah.
Every time we sing that in my church, I come to that line and I think, this is the theme song for the OPC. There is at least shared a certain pilgrim mindset for Pinellas. The fire helped establish that. They lost their...
Yeah, they literally lived in tents.
Right. And the OPC has been a marginalized and disenfranchised a denomination that has metaphorically lived in tents. So those are kind of points of commonality that are important to observe. And also, as Caroline suggested, the anti-modernism for which the OPC was known, especially in the wake of the controversy that led to its birth, was certainly not lost among the Pinellists. And there were a few other institutional options available to them at the time. It's not surprising that Pinellas may have been more captured by the OPC's anti-modernism than by its forthright espousal of the Reformed faith. This has been true of a lot of groups that have stumbled across the OPC. they're captured at first by that, by the anti-modernism of the church, and they learn later that there's, that the church seeks positively to commend the Reformed faith, and that becomes something of a learning curve that's often pretty steep. The usual pattern is churches like this that prove to be misfits leave the OPC. I think the remarkable thing about the Peniel story is that Calvary stayed in the OPC.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd be curious, maybe this forms part of the second part of your story, Caroline, but I'd be interested in reflections on why it endured in the in this denomination that, that seemed to be incompatible.
Well, I think that brings up an interesting point in that I think that as much as I will say, and I think it's important to say, that Peniel at the beginning was full of squirrels. It was a rather strange place, and it, you know, and I would have to say absolutely, it had even some marks early on of developing into a cult. I don't blame people for seeing it and looking askance at it and saying this was really an odd organization, and to have it come into the OPC was a very strange thing. It was a strange choice because of how opposed they were to so many of the doctrines held by the OPC, and in fact, Peniel just simply had no doctrinal ideas at all. Mostly, they were led from moment to moment by whatever happened to they happened to feel peace about at the moment. So they were not really a theologically strong organization at all. So it seemed like a strange combination, and I think the mistake sometimes people make in analyzing it is to think that Peniel went through a lot of soul searching and reflection when they decided to join the OPC and thought they were finding a good fit. I don't really think that it went that far in their thinking. They were, I think one thing that's important to realize about Peniel is that they were all kids. They were all in 18, 19, 20 years old. They were all from non-Christian families, almost exclusively from non-Christian families. They didn't know much about the Bible. They didn't know much about God. We had, you know, G. Travers Lawyer, who came later. He had been an atheist. What did he know about God? So you have these people who really, they have found the Bible, and they may have made a lot of mistakes in their understanding of it, but they genuinely wanted to follow God. I don't think there was any sense that they were trying to oppose the OPC. And so I think when they came into it, it's more just simply ignorance. They didn't know. And certainly a lot of their doctrines were opposed to the OPC. But what you see over time, and of course I'll get into that more in the subsequent article, and I'm also working on writing a book about G. Travers Lawyer, but as you go on in through history, you see that Peniel really does start to grow, starts to change. So that Peniel, you know, Peniel just had its 80th anniversary. I mean, it's a very long history of Peniel. And what you see at the beginning, that what Ray Miners and Mildred McCullough and some of these people were, was not who they were at the end. And so in that sense, I think it's a story of redemption. They really, I think, even they believe that God was leading them so on by these impulses in their minds, and yet I look at it and say God was leading them, not the way that they thought. But mm-hmm. It's a story, I think, really of redemption.
Indeed. You mentioned Ray Miners and having come into the OPC, but let's back up a little and talk about him. And it's interesting that there's this connection with Westminster Theological Seminary, but also we have to remember the context of the early 30s, especially with the modernist fundamentalist debates. And J. Gresham Machen was in the news quite a bit. He was kind of an evangelical, or better yet, a conservative Christian celebrity, for better or worse. I'll let Carl Truman sort that out, whether he was a celebrity or not. But we have here is that Machen is the face of a movement to some degree. And people identify people that are conservative and that do not want to go down the route of liberalism or modernism were identifying with Machen, but nevertheless, over some basic issues without understanding some of the other things that went along with Machen's reformed views. We see that even in, 1937, right? John, we find that many people broke off of the OPC very early on because...
And that continued to happen. Yep. And that's a story that just recurs.
Yes.
Throughout our history. That's right.
And so you have people here at Peniel, I think, being young and impressionable, they have their own views, but at the same time see Machen in the news. And do you think that's some of the reason why people like Ray Miners and some of the others ended up at Westminster without having, you know, grown up in a confessional home, for instance?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it was directly Machen. Mm-hmm. That was the only link that the group had with Reformed theology early on, was that that Ray Miners had attended a speech by Machen. Machen, this was back in, I think, 1931, and Machen was, of course, touring around and giving speeches here and there, and Ray just went along to hear him, and he heard him talk about these things that certainly Ray, who had been, you know, converted in the Penniallist group, could identify with, and that Ray had grown up as a very nominal Lutheran family, and he didn't really know anything about God, and he was told just be good and so on, and there wasn't a focus at all on the cross of Christ. There was no focus on really the justification and the understanding about the forgiveness of sins and that you need to obey God and so on. There wasn't any of that involved in his upbringing. And so when he heard Machen, then he was impressed by him. He thought they were on the same page. He thought, this is the, somebody who's really standing up for the Bible, wants people to follow the Lord. And so that was really what kept him with that in the back of his mind through the years as he went to college. And then the reason that when he heard that Westminster Theological Seminary had been founded, decided to attend there. And that was, when he came in, he had never, I think, had any exposure to Reformed faith other than simply that speech by Machen and maybe reading a couple of Machen's books.
For someone like Miners, if you were conservative and you weren't dispensational, you had no other place to go.
Yeah, that's a good point.
There was Westminster. There was no Fuller, Gordon Conwell, Trinity. It was Westminster. Mm-hmm. So someone like him coming to Westminster was not at all unusual. And I think, Caroline, I think you describe him befuddled at the teaching of Van Til in the classroom, or maybe that was in Charlie Dennison's article. That was typical of a lot of these young men who heard of Machen and came to Westminster. The learning curve was steep for a lot of them.
Mm. Was it the group's desire for them to have somebody that would become an actual ordained minister? How was that decided, and how was Raymond encouraged to go off and study?
Some of the details of those early decisions just are not available to me, and I don't think they're available anywhere. So I don't know exactly what happened. I know that certainly that many, many young men were encouraged to go into ministry. In fact, almost all of the young men, if you look at the pictures from the early days, you can see, oh, he became a minister, he became a minister, he became, it's harder to pick out one that didn't. And so, eventually Peniel sent maybe at least 30 young men to Westminster.
Wow.
And so, and that, in addition to several other seminaries, I might add. And so there was a big emphasis on producing ministers that would spread the gospel, and especially, and they would say it explicitly, and spread the teachings of Peniel. So I think that early on, that was just simply a focus that they wanted to have some credibility and as an organization. And how you do that is you send someone to seminary. You have a minister, that an actual ordained minister. And so Ray Miners was the first, and he had been converted by the group. He almost immediately started making plans for his ministry and attended Westminster. But then following that, there were many, many others that did.
Hmm. Let's talk a little about the Peniel Prayer Council. I think that's an interesting thing to focus on, to understand the mindset of the group and how it worked. It seems rather amazing or astonishing or surprising that so many these people would grow up and go off to seminary. But how did the group work? Can you speak about the mechanism of this prayer council and how decisions were made as a group?
The prayer council is an interesting thing. And one of the things that I find so interesting about it is that it was such a lifelong thing for people, that the people who were on it at the beginning, and including Ray Miners and Mildred McCullough and Robert McCullough and and several others were some of the same ones that were on it, you know, all the way until they died, pretty much, you know, for decades, literally. And now the president of the Prayer Council is Dan Miners, who is the son of Ray Miners. So it's something that really carried on just, you know, generations and generations, and it, or not, I mean, years and years, and even down through generations. So it was, the idea was that these people would come together and they would pray about any decisions that were before them, and they would try to feel God's leading in one direction or another. And the idea was that if that they should all feel the same thing. If God was leading them in some ways, and they all had their hearts right before God, then God should give them all the same leading about what something should be. And then because of the fact that it was for the whole group, they would have confirmation. They would, and there was a big emphasis on it had to be unanimous, that there was, if it was from God, God would tell them all the same thing, and they would all know what was right. And so how this worked out practically, I think, is that there was a lot of pressure for conformity, and that if someone was found to have a differing opinion from the majority, many times this was evidence that there was something wrong in your life, that you had some, were hiding some secret sin, because you know, the devil is influencing you in some way in order to come up with something different from what God is telling you. There's some blockage between you and God that you must get rid of immediately. And so there was a very strong pressure for conformity. And this down the line, of course, began to cause some problems with within the organizations. People began to have differing viewpoints on things. And then, of course, you know, what happens in churches. But it was the Peniel Prayer Council held a very strong sway over people because they were seen as the more spiritually superior ones. And so people would bring their problems to them and say, I don't know what to do in this situation. I don't know if I should marry this person. And the Peniel Prayer Council would pray about it, and they would get back to you with what God said on the matter. And you were expected then to follow the leading of the Lord. So the Peniel Prayer Council would not necessarily seek people out and tell them what to do, but they certainly acted as an intermediary, that if you went and consulted them about what the will of God was, you were then expected to comply with them, because after all, they were the spiritually superior. They would say, we have more experience at this, and so you should listen to us.
Wow. But then again, there seems to be kind of a pseudo form of discipline where if you don't conform, or if you don't, if you're the one person that isn't agreeing with the rest of the group because you're not at rest or at peace with it, then, like you said, it must be a problem with you and your faith.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Caroline, do you see the prayer council evolving in their understanding of their work over time? Do they develop a more nuanced view of the will of God, or is that sort of an enduring feature, as you understand it, of their the way they understand their task?
Well, that's an interesting question, because again, it comes back to that whole thing of, you know, there's a Peniel stretched over decades, and it, you know, what it believed in this era is not necessarily what it believed in the next era. And that is one area in which I think the OPC had a very strong impact on Peniel over time. And I don't, you know, of course, I don't want to necessarily give the game away, but I think that G. Travers Sloyer was a very strong positive influence on changing a lot of those ideas in Peniel. And because throughout the 30s and 40s, that really was the way that they practiced, and they would come down hard on people who did not agree with them or who would not take their perspective on things. And sometimes that was good, and that they would confront people who were in sin and serious sin. There was one case in which they stood up to a man who was beating his wife, mm-hmm. and in a very brave and way, and rescued her and her children, and so on. And so they did many good things, but in addition, of course, they were very heavy-handed and sometimes minor decisions or things that were really, you know, outside of their business. But over time, I think you definitely do see a maturing, a better understanding, and I think especially with the influence of G. Travers Sloyer, that they begin to consider the possibility that these things were not necessarily infallible words from God, and that there were some things that were just strictly adiaphora.
I was interested in how the group moves from being a Bible camp group to wanting to form a congregation with a minister who's trained and credentialed. Can you describe that process for us and how they then came to connect with the OPC? You've already shared some of that, but if you could share some more.
And well, from both sides, too, not only from the Peniel side, but also the presbytery side. It'd be interesting to hear both sides of that.
That, I think, is the, one of the funniest parts of the story, is that when I researched it and I finally came up with this conclusion and said to, in fact, to my pastor, we became a congregation, we became a church because the Wayside Inn burned down. That was the long and short of it. The group had bought this hotel, it burned to the ground, as I mentioned before, and as a result, they came into disfavor with the Methodist church that they had been a part of. And I don't, again, a lot of these details are lost about exactly who said what or why, but I think at that point it seemed that the Methodist church had had enough of all of these leadings. They had been raised a lot of money for this building and then only to see it burn down and so on. And so at this point they were set, it seems that they were set out of the Methodist church. There was certainly a break. And so they decided to strike out on their own and to form their own congregation and to form a church where they could be entirely dependent upon these leadings and no one would tell them no. And so that was the reason that they formed the congregation. And their decision to join the denomination of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church really came through Ray Miners. He had just graduated from seminary and weeks before. And he suggested that they should join the Orthodox Presbyterian denomination. They didn't know anything about it. They had never held any kind of classes that, you know, about Reformed theology. But, well, Ray Miners suggested it was a good idea, and they said, okay, that sounds good. So Ray Miners takes it up with the presbytery and brings the church into the presbytery. And I think to understand it from the presbytery side, you just have to see at the particular point where they were in their history, you have to realize this was 1938. The Orthodox Presbyterian denomination had formed in 1936, so they were barely 2 years old. And they, of course, were formed during a great deal of trauma, really, in separating from the PCUSA. There was a lot of just devastation going on in the presbytery, and that you had people like John Rankin, who had a church of 150 in the PCUSA. His church was down to 10, and they had lost their building. We had in Second Parish, where they were in the middle of a court battle to keep their building, there was all these kinds of troubles going on. And, of course, what happens when people form a denomination is that after the common enemy is gone, they often start finding reasons to fight amongst themselves, and that happened too. So there was a split in one of the churches, and it was just a messy, messy thing where the pastor actually was suing the church, so they had that lawsuit going on. There was all of these big, big problems. And in the middle of this comes the Peniel group, and they're young and they're enthusiastic, and they have they want to call this pastor, who's a graduate from Westminster Theological Seminary, and it must have really looked wonderful to the presbytery. It must have seemed like very good news. I mean, that's somewhat speculative on my part, but you can certainly imagine it from their perspective, that amid all these problems, here comes this young, very dynamic congregation who's saying, we want to join the OPC. They want to call this pastor, who is a very well-trained from Westminster Theological Seminary, and it seems as though the presbytery just simply didn't ask a lot of questions. They had bigger problems on their hand. They had bigger fish to fry, and so they said, sure. They didn't even place the church under any kind of oversight by another session. They just simply brought it in.
I think everything Caroline says is true about what was going on in 38, and it's true even today. Presbytery resources are often stretched quite thin. It's you can't do the kind of due diligence that one hopes in every case. There's so much you can do in terms of vetting a particular group that's interested in coming in. This presbytery probably had its hands full with all kinds of issues, and so these things happen. They've happened since receiving Calvary Church, and the OPC is a marginalized denomination that has, over the course of its history, welcomed misfits, and some of those misfits turn out to fit in after all, and some of them decide to find greener pastures somewhere else.
Yeah.
Again, the remarkable story, and I'm eager to read part two to have this fleshed out, is how Calvary stayed. I think that's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I look forward to that as well. Jeff?
I think that's the story, is I don't know, Caroline, if you're wanting to, you know, tip your hat, so to speak, or show your cards, whatever metaphor you want to use in terms of the second part. That would be the fascinating part, is what happened. The Peniel, as you pointed out, still exists. So it's not merely a historical phenomenon. It's a present day organization. Are they still located at Lake Luzerne?
Yes, they're still located on the same properties. They have gone through a lot of changes in the past few years, and they certainly are not affiliated with Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church anymore. And I think they've reinvented themselves recently to the extent that there are not that many people involved now that would even remember these people that I am speaking about. So there's not a lot of connection, I think, with some of the origins of Peniel in Peniel anymore. And that when Ray Miners passed away and G. Travers Sloyer and some of the main guys, I think the Reform connection more or less died out. Certainly Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church staying in the denomination is, I think, something that is remarkable. And it took a lot of staying power, I think. It's something that I think is a positive thing that can be said, that sometimes people leave because they can't change, because they can't learn and they can't adjust. And for all the bad things you can say about the people who were involved in Peniel, and there are many that could be said, even in the second part, I think it becomes very clear they made mistakes for which they should have been disciplined, maybe even more severely than they were. And yet at the same time, I think sanctification is a process for everyone, and that's something that we tend to forget sometimes. And many of us, the people that we were, including myself, back in our teens and early 20s, are, thank God, not who we are today. And so I think that that's a positive thing that we can say when we look at overall what was the fruit of all of this. Well, there's Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Schenectady at the end of the day. And so I think that's, you know, a remarkable thing about this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, we look forward to part two. Hopefully we can revisit this when it comes out. Again, the current issue and the current article, though, The Early History of Peniel Bible Conference, Part 1, Zeal Without Knowledge, 1933 through 1938. It's in the Westminster Theological Journal, Fall 2013, Volume 75, Number 2. Thanks so much, Caroline, for joining us today. This has been just a fascinating discussion and an interesting history.
Well, thank you.
I do want to point people around to various places on the web. Of course, you can visit Calvary OPC in Schenectady. We often talk about Calvary OPC in Glenside just because we have some personal connection, or Calvary OPC in Ringgoes, New Jersey. But this is Calvary OPC in Schenectady, New York, calvaryopcny.org. And please visit catechismforkids.com. This is Caroline's website, and there's so many great resources here, downloadable workbooks, also paperback workbooks. There's some music, all sorts of resources for kids and training them up in the way that they should go. So visit catechismforkids.com. I'll place a link to that in the episode description. We do also want to point people to our own website, reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as how to get in touch with us. We love hearing from you. So visit us online today and get in touch with us and let us know what you think and how we can better serve you and the church to God's glory. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.